You.
Hello, hello. Welcome to Two Crickets in the Thorn Tree. I'm up your host, Nicholas Larimer, joined, as ever, by the other half of your hosts.
Gabriel Grousel.
It's like if you called some sort of phone line for like sort of over-the-phone therapy, I feel like that would be the thing saying you are, that would be the voice saying you are number 68 in line.
Like slightly torturous, also maybe comforting, but
yeah,
sort of bed of nails comforting, like you can lie down on it.
So we have a theme for today we've just come up with, and that is people who should be fired or at least should get in trouble seem to be getting fired and getting in trouble.
Amazing.
Which, and I don't know if I complained about it on the show or whether I just ranted to one of my colleagues or relatives about it, but I did go on a while ago about how no one gets fired for the right reasons. You get fired for making a joke about a sexist joke or saying something that gets construed as racist, but you don't get fired for, you know, accidentally killing people, breaking something, tearing your organization apart, losing your company money, all those kind of reasons. And yet, this week, there's been a couple of stories that have all just kind of come together where someone has gotten in trouble for good reasons, and something like just desserts have been delivered. So which one do we want to start with? We've got some American ones and some South African ones.
I want to dwell on the fact that life is very tough. At a personal level, at a public level, there's all kinds of ways that life is tough.
We're starting from a very broad scope here.
I mean, I'll say, okay, so in the last 2 weeks, right? I mean, in the same period that we're going to be covering, GDP numbers came out and employment numbers came out, and I have been Debbie Downer. What's up with Debbie? Can I be like Gabby Downer?
No, dude, it's just alliteration. That's, you know, so I don't know.
I've been Donald Downer.
Daisy Downer. Damien Downer.
I've been declining Dionysus. I've been Desolatory Dolores. I've been Depressed Little D. Anyway, I've been a downer because on two things, right? So the one thing is GDP numbers in South Africa. They say up 1.9% quarter on quarter. So from the end of last year to the first 3 months of this year, a 1.9% improvement.
Reported as higher than expected.
In real terms, it's down 1.9%. The seasonal adjustment is basically 4%. So the economy actually shrinks by 2%. They say it's grown by 2% because they've bumped it up through seasonal adjustment by 4%. Now, that is not totally out of whack. Before the pandemic, you would see 3%, 2.5% adjustments. They're adjusting it more this time than 2018, 2017, 2016, 2019. I don't know that that's justified because usually the seasonal adjustment makes sense because Christmas time is a big bang and then the new year is like a bit of a hangover. I don't know how much that counts under lockdown madness and travel restrictions and all kind of stuff. I don't know. Anyway, so bit of a Debbie Downer just pointing that out. On the employment numbers, the NEET rate, not an employment education or training rate for 15 to 34-year-olds is up by 2%, climbing to 46.3. Anyway, so that's terrible. By 3%, 2.7%, nearly 3%. So that's very bad. Anyway, okay, so there have been bad things, and life gives you, like, BS burgers. But then sometimes there's a little just dessert afterwards, and it's good to enjoy that. So I don't know where's the right place to start. Maybe I think Busisiwe Mkhwebane is so obvious.
Yeah, let's start with her.
Let's make a second or third. Oh, okay, you want to start with her?
Yeah, let's start with her. So
okay,
she. So we talked about last time about our beloved president Cyril has gotten into a bit of a spot of bother. And it doesn't seem to have improved that much for him this past week, I don't think. And you can already see that a lot of his cheerleaders in the media are feeling a little bit anxious because they've set up this false dichotomy where if Cyril's not there, then the quote unquote bad ANC will resume power. Justice Malala, I think, said this explicitly. And that will be a return to the days of Jacob Zuma, you know, when the economy grew at 2.5%. But anyway.
The bad old days are much better than these days.
Yes. So, and of course, businesses where our public protector is, she is very obviously a member of the anti-Cyril faction. Not the RET faction, as you've made a lot of, you've spent a lot of time pointing out, which I think is. Yes. No, I agree, actually. I do agree. I now just call them the Zuma faction because that's more accurate, I think, to be honest.
Yeah.
And yeah, so she's very obviously a sort of a foot soldier, a shock trooper for the Zuma faction. And so she jumped with total glee and eagerness upon this case to investigate it, to presumably find against Cyril Ramaphosa. And, what is it, yesterday or the day before? She got suspended by the president. Now, that's probably the worst. This is in terms of like a time to suspend the public protector. She has had an incredibly awful track record. She was obviously not going to be particularly fit for the job at the beginning because she was so obviously a sort of partisan hack. She then got tons of court judgments against her going through.
The courts have banked like proverbially spanked her more than any public official. Like
right. She has wasted an enormous amount of taxpayers' money, getting beaten in court by everyone from, I think Helen Zille was one of them. Anyway, she's just lost 1,000 times in court. None of that. Oh, she's also facing impeachment, of course, by Parliament. None of that is enough, apparently, to move the needle until finally she decides to act against the president and then she's suspended within a few days. So, I mean, she should have been suspended a long time ago, but at least she.
Okay,
is
so hold on, just a small advertising break for the best newspaper that I don't pay for but read, the New York Times. So, Cyril Ramaphosa is actually taking questions from journalists right now as we record.
Oh,
I'm recording it on TV. It's amazing. Our colleagues, we have been discussing this internally for the last 2 weeks. I mean, it's a constant truth, but I think that Uncle Cyril has bugged our offices some of the time. Anyway, it's great. We've got the best ideas. And it seems some of it's getting through. So we've been complaining about how he hasn't taken a single live question from a journalist outside of America when he was asked about the farm murders. And he said, well, don't worry, there are zero.
There are none. Just stop worrying about that.
He hasn't you can't remember seeing him take live questions because it hasn't really happened. He's taken he's done fireside meetings with people like Audrey Anderson. Anyway, he's taking live questions. I sat through a little bit of it hoping that someone would say what you've just said. Okay. Everyone agrees that, not everyone, but there is a widespread consensus that Busisiwe Mkhwebane's suspension is justified. She's just appealed to court to reverse it. They've said no. The justifications are impeachment by Parliament, a series of court rulings against her. You have all the legal standing in the world to dismiss her. Why did you only do it after she brought a case against you with strong prima facie evidence of either illegal or unethical behavior or both?
Right.
So Bloomberg asked a question, didn't ask that question. New York Times asked a question. New York Times asked three questions. None of them were that question. One of them was, do you think your critics are overblowing the farm gate theory?
What is it that the Americans call that? A softball question.
They call that a softball question. Why? Because in softball, you don't even throw the ball at the batter. You just put it stationary on a tee and hope. Softball is a game for 4-year-olds. And so are certain questions from the New York Times. They did ask a nice question, which was, okay, you say it's not illegal. We believe you. Do you think it was wrong? Like, would you do it again the same way if you could do it again? I suppose that's them being tough. Anyway, the point is that, Busisiwe Mkhwebane, this is, I think this case, this is so harsh, and as much as, you know, everyone must hate me because I sometimes say a nice thing about the evil people in the Russians, that's to say the Russians. I do actually, I think the worst I ever hurt a Russian's feelings, was I once said that maybe it would have been better if Hitler had invaded the USSR first, and the UK and France and those other countries didn't have to get involved, and the Nazis and the Soviet communists just sort of destroyed each other. Because I think maybe that would have been better. Anyway, he found that very offensive. I think this is a little bit like that. It's like two forces that are both not being their best selves, that are kind of canceling each other out.
From the world of evil Reaganite neocon interventionists, the common version of that story is this is the Iran-Iraq war. You want both sides to lose.
Yes, there we go. So, and I mean, I guess at this stage, I do want Cyril Ramaphosa to win if he takes up our policy ideas, and we're still trying to hammer away.
Well, when he does that, I'll be very happy, but I don't think that day is any day soon.
No. Okay, so the Mkhwebane one, I mean, I think that I don't really know what else there is to say about it other than the real question is, who does she get replaced by? Is it someone with teeth? Part of what's interesting there is an important detail on the Gupta arrests I was reminded of. We mentioned this in the show, I think. Hermione Chiliomir? Is that how you say her name? She's like Hermann Chiliomir, but the girl version of the name, who was the former director of the Independent Directorate, or the former head of the Independent Directorate, who was basically stepped down at the end of last, announced her resignation at the end of last year and then actually stepped down at the beginning of this year. The Independent Directorate is sort of the last vestige of the Scorpions. You know, there were the Scorpions and there were the Hawks, and the Hawks are kind of the ID. Although the functions were split after Glenister II. Anyway, the point is that it's, you know, a special branch of investigations into, let's say, high crimes and misdemeanors, things that might be politically or state-wise very threatening. And her complaints, I mean, I thought her resignation was one of the most damning things in the last season against Ramaphosa's administration, because she was basically throwing shade at Shamila Batoy very subtly and very professionally, saying that she's resigning because the resources she needs to do her job are not there, and the efforts that she's made to get them have failed, and so it's time to go away. Or maybe she officially said that she's resigning for personal reasons, but she allowed like leaks to happen to say, you know, she's irritated because she feels she's being stonewalled effectively. She's not getting what she needs to drive things through. And the very last thing that she did was get the red notice on the Guptas. Literally the day she quit, she managed to get that through. So to me, she reminds me in that sense a little bit of Ahmed Kathrada, who really, in my opinion, if you want to draw the watershed, what is the moment that Jacob Zuma's career ended or changed direction? It was Ahmed Kathrada's funeral, when a whole bunch of ANC guys, including Mbeki and Trevor Manuel, etc., Khilema Motlanthe, went to go mourn there and make speeches, and they read out Kathrada's letter, and from beyond the grave, Kathrada said, "Jacob Zuma, bugger off. You're robbing this country, and it's not very nice.
Yeah.
It's counter-revolutionary, reactionary, and so on." And this is like another beyond the grave, like the Guptas are getting arrested now on a warrant that we issued with someone who's been removed. So, and I'm saying that because why am I skeptical about Ramaphosa? Well, there's a reason. Like, I think if Ramaphosa was never mind the ideology stuff. Obviously, I'm against BEE, he's for BEE forever, etc. So we're going to disagree about that. But on a corruption, we all agree you've got to go after it. Surely to goodness, if Ramaphosa was the real reformer that he was, he hears those complaints coming up from the independent directorate's office, and he makes the move, and he says, dude, you've got to get these people what they want. If they need more resources, give them more resources. If there's someone getting in the way of that, get rid of that person. And when she makes a bit of a complaint, right, you know, he phones and says, take back your resignation.
This is a criticism I've heard many times, that a lot of the people, senior people in the ANC who are implicated in some sort of wrongdoing, they have cases for which there is evidence that's already pretty well known. There doesn't have to be an enormous amount of investigation to take the cases to court. There's
zero investigation. The Zondo Commission has, like, it's literally all already on record.
Even before the Zondo Commission, I think, like, against Ace Makashule in particular, there was a whole bunch of stuff. But none of that has ever moved on. If a corruption case has moved on, it's always moved on something that's much more recent, and there's like it's the kind of thing that is going to be stuck in the courts for the next 4 or 5 years. What I've been told by sort of legal eagle type people is that there is an enormous amount of stuff you could be doing that's just not been done, quite frankly. And I think,
you know, I've been told the same by people who I went to cocktail soirees and dinner parties with, fancy pants legal eagles. And I would say in 2018, 2019, what's going? Why haven't there been any prosecutions? Shimon Abatoy is letting me down. And they'd say, no. It's still too soon. Now it's 2022. And they're saying, this is outrageous.
Yeah. So the eagerness is certainly not there.
Okay, so the question is, Nicholas, shall we both send letters to the president to ask if he will make us public protector? I think it's not worth it because you have to have like a law degree. You know, I sent him a letter saying, can I be in the BEE advisory council?
Look, I feel like you could probably put it off, but I don't know. You know, you know my feelings about like law in general, so I'm not sure if I'd be the greatest person to be the public protector.
Fire them into the sun. Dude, great would that be to have as a public protector? You go to the public protector, like, I need protection, and you're like, okay, who's the bad guy? Fire them into the sun. I think that was. You do it once, you'd fire one person into the sun, but it would send a message.
Well, yeah, no, I feel that I would, but if Ace Makashule is not, if there's enough political will to put Ace Makashule behind bars, then I don't think that there's enough political will to give me the power to do what needed to be done, so to speak.
Dude, then there's not enough political will to blow a blade of grass 2 centimeters across a tabletop. There's like...
Yes. We first need to make sure that the entire National Executive Committee of the ANC is agreed before we touch the blade of grass. And
we also need to ask the greater blast.
Oh my word. The greater blast. Grass? Grass.
Friday afternoon. Okay, so this is... I mean, I really do think that this is going to be an interesting test. If Ramaphosa, who would be the best? If he was really good guy.
I don't know. Do you have
Dennis Breitenbach?
Oh, yeah, well.
No, of course, why not?
But she's so far outside the realm of possibility. But yes,
If I was president and I wanted to save this country, and I was an ANC guy, I'm a childhood lover of the ANC. It's easy for me to imagine still loving the ANC if I was inside. I know a couple of people that are still inside that I respect because they think, you know, if you want to change the thing, you guys talk about a coalition party taking over. It's never going to happen. Someone's got that. If you disagree about that fact, if you think the South African public is so married to the ANC that it's never going to vote it out, then you've got to try and change it from inside. Okay, so a really good person, maybe slightly lazy, whatever. Good person. I'm talking about myself, not the president. is in charge of things, and he wants to establish a public protector who, through the dictates of Chapter 9 of the Constitution, which lay out the powers of the public protector and other bodies like the Human Rights Commission, the public protector really is given some leeway to make real change. And yet it's short. It's not the same as the public prosecutor. I think it's the perfect place to put someone who has, I mean, it's a position that begs for a name. And if you put an independent, if you put someone who's independent of the party that has the most, you know, after the Zonder Commission, you really can say, look, here are the people implicated prima facie by the commission. They almost all are in the ANC. Those that aren't are in the EFF. We are going to ask this person. We'll ask her to give up her DA party membership. And we'll ask her, and on condition, I'm pretty sure the public prosecutor can't, she wouldn't be able to be a DA member. She wouldn't be able to make stump speeches for them. It'd be a sacrifice for her. It'd be a sacrifice for the DA. But it'd be so like,
there was actually a time when I believe that when Ramaphosa first came to office and was appointing, before he appointed Shamila Batoy, I think there were actually rumors that Glynis Breytenbach might be selected as a.
Yep.
And that was, that was when everyone had a, even us had a much more positive view of Ramaphosa as possibly someone who might push back on some of the worst things that had happened during the
Zimbabwe. Okay, so who would be the most hilarious? I mean, the most hilarious would be Dalian Porfu.
No, he wouldn't be the most hilarious, but he'd be in the top three for sure.
Okay, who, dude, it has to be someone with a law degree, hey?
Yeah, I don't know then. Yeah, maybe Dalian Porfu then.
I mean, I'm sure that there are lots of like, MPs and so on.
There is almost certainly a ANC aligned lawyer who works for a provincial department somewhere who is a very loyal cadre of the revolution and also doesn't really believe that the law should get in the way of a good bit of public prosecution, who I'm sure they could find to be the public protector.
Okay, so this is kind of a good case, but probably a bummer if you don't get a good public prosecutor. And for a good example, outside of the obvious corruption of why a public prosecutor would be great, you know, I've been trying for quite a while to see if I could raise
public
some money.
Public protector or public prosecutor?
Sorry, public protector, thanks. I mean, I would love to take a case against the government on the basis that the command council or the department, the Kochter department, broke the law during the lockdown, which continues. How did they break the law? Well, the law says if you subvert people's liberties in a serious way during a state of disaster, then you have to monitor how that works, whether it's working, what detrimental effects that's having, what positive effects that's having. You have to monitor it. And you have to monitor it for each thing that you do.
Right.
So you can't...
Yeah. If you're violating liberty, the onus is on you to keep proving it. You can't just sort of half-ass.
And this
it.
Is... Look, this is a common law principle. And I think it's very easy to find that. I don't think you have to get too inventive to find that in Section 36 of the Constitution. But it's also just straightforwardly in black and white English in... the Disaster Management Act, where it says in Section 127 or something, for every intervention there must be continuous monitoring and da-da-da-da and reporting back from time to time. The government hasn't done that. My problem is I can't find 2 million rand to take these guys to court to do that. And I'm still going to go try it and so on and so on. But guess what? That's what the public protector is for. I should be able to go to a public protector and say, let's do this, and they'll be serious, and they'll go and do it.
You know, I'm a member of the public, and I'm being abused. Please protect me.
Yeah, millions and millions and millions of South Africans have been abused for the last 2 years. The government needs to learn a lesson from this. It'll be so good for everyone. Let's do it. No, it's not going to happen. And the test is, whoever Ramaphosa appoints next, could you imagine that person taking that case seriously and using it to... You know, if the facts lead to the conclusion that not only Dlamini Zuma, but also someone in the RET camp, the Ramaphosa transformation camp, needs to be punished, would they both get punished? That's the test. Okay. So it's a good reason, firing, but it's a very mixed bag of a firing.
The reason,
but we can't dwell forever because we need a favor of just desserts.
No, we will move on to the less consequential ones. The reason I chuckled so much when you said Glynis Breakenbach was because I think for me, the reason we're not going to get a great public protector is because even Thuli Madonsela, who is still very much in the ANC sort of ideological universe and worldview, and I think was a loyal ANC member, she still, just by at least sort of talking about the sheer facts of the matter, you know, on Nkandla and on some of these other issues, did such damage to the political fortunes of the ANC, particularly Zuma, that they will never, ever make the mistake ever again of not having a completely 100% dedicated to the movement cadre in that position.
It does kind of make you think, gosh, couldn't our constitution have not had the public protector be decided by
the president?
The president.
Parliament? No, I'm not a huge fan of the Chapter 9 institutions. I think that they probably could be set up in a better way, but.
Oh, dude, remember, can you imagine if you could vote for the president of the public protector? Like, we can't vote for anything directly in this country. If you could just vote for, that would have been a nice, you know, people, the classic split is between the symbolic head. Anyway, it might also be a terrible idea, but, you know, you've got the executive head and the symbolic head, and usually you can vote for one of those directly if you do have two. In South Africa, you can't vote for anything directly. But if you've been able to, if there was like a public protector role that you could vote for directly. But then I said, maybe it'd be a problem because you could have just a spoiler who had launched relentless false investigations into an administration and kneecap their ability to get anything done. I don't know. I do remember when we visited the Concord last Friday, 2-3 weeks ago, whatever it was, we saw the Gender Equality Commission, Chapter 9 Institution.
Yes.
Wow. When you see it, then you really can hear the deafening silence of its impact and work. Like, you have to see it to believe that it exists, and you have to actually believe that it exists to hear how little it does. It's amazing. And that really is, I mean, I want to say, I did this SABC One show yesterday, which was quite jolly. And like, just chatting before and after, I was reminded of a stunning result from our surveys. 2020, 2021, we see a huge spike. You know, we always do these surveys. The first question we ask is, what's the biggest problem in the country? And it's always unemployment first, and then it's like crime and drugs and corruption and all the things you'd really think it is, unless you watch the TV, and then you'd think it's like racism and feminism and all kinds of things. But during the pandemic, during the lockdown, domestic violence
surged.
Jeez, went to like third or second. From like 2% of people thought it was the biggest deal to like second after unemployment.
Yeah, sort of like 30% of the population basically saying that this is the biggest issue.
And if you just hang out with people who know what it's, I mean, people stuck at home, frustrated, booze, beatings,
depression, anyway, from the collapsing economy, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. I can't think of any reason to give flowers to the old gender equality, to that Chapter 9 institution, which should be making that their issue in terms of actually doing anything. For example, challenging the government and saying, can you justify this these policies that seem to be having this effect? Can we maybe tone it down? Anything like just asking for an investigation or saying, we can see that it's having this effect. We need to establish some concrete way of dealing with it. Of course, it is a very difficult thing to deal with. Okay. So, Nick, can't we talk about one of the nice ones? This is a good one, but it's a complicated one.
Pick another one.
I called this Selena Gomez by mistake, which was terrible, terrible. Felicia Somnus.
Yes, mostly because Selena Gomez is a former Disney star who's become a big pop idol, which Felicia Somnes very certainly isn't. So, I don't know. Let me
I should just explain. It's a little bit because their names rhyme. It's also because when I go to quiz, there's always a question about pop culture.
Yeah.
And my answer is always Justin Bieber. And then sometimes they're like, dude, it's definitely not Justin Bieber. And I'm like, how do you know? Who is it then? And they're like, I don't know, but it's clearly a woman. And then I say, okay, Selena Gomez. Those are the only two.
It's your go-to celebrity.
Yeah.
Just shooting in the dark. I think she's kind of out of date, though. I don't keep up with pop music particularly, so.
What about Justin Bieber? I don't know if he's in date or out of date.
I don't even know either. Anyway.
There we go. So Selena, so if you don't know the answer, it's Selena Gomez. But this is Felicia Somnes.
Yeah, so this is one of those things that's like such a kind of modern journalism story. And as with most modern journalism stories these days, the centerpiece is sort of Twitter. So what happens? There's a guy who works for the Washington Post called David Weigel. What was his surname again? I think it's Weigel.
Something like
that. Anyway, he is a senior reporter. He reports on primaries, and you know, basically the elections going on around right now. So he's a pretty busy dude for them. He's in the field right now looking at a lot of these primaries that are taking place across the country where the different parties are choosing their candidates for the midterms.
Including one where someone got fired, but we'll get to that later.
Yes. Felicia Somnes is, I think she's a senior correspondent also for the Washington Post, who I think is the White House senior correspondent. I'll just check that now. But anyway, she's also got a bit of a checkered history with the Washington Post, which is, I think recently she tried to sue them for some sort of discrimination and she lost the case in court. However, she still worked there. She was cruising her Twitter timeline and she noticed that David, her colleague, had retweeted something and that what he had retweeted was the following joke. All women are bi. You just have to work out whether it's bi, bipolar or bisexual. So she took a screenshot of this retweet.
Oh, lordy, lordy, lordy.
And said, so great to work at a place that has, that allow, where retweets like this are allowed. And thus began the Twitter drama. Immediately,
at this stage, it seems like high school.
Yes.
It seems like not my favorite joke, but I could definitely see myself laughing at that joke in a comedy club or around a fire, which is told by someone well.
It's just kind of, yeah, it's just kind of a bit sort of
out of context on Twitter.
Kind of lame.
It's a bit lame.
You know, it's like one of those very old, boring sexist jokes. You know, the sexist jokes are always about men that they're stupid and about women that they're crazy. This is like so sort of common in humor. I think that basically no one takes it even vaguely seriously.
Right. I don't, so what I'm trying to say also though is that her comeback seems pretty, I mean, the word allowed is worrying. It's like, there's a little bit, but there's also part of me that feels like Slavoj Žižek. I remember sitting in,
Slavoj Žižek. That Slovenian in here. No conversation is complete without
Slavoj without a little Žižek mention. So I remember, at Princeton University, Slavoj Žižek came to make his first sort of well-respected lecture series to launch his rock star flame for a moment. And there was Peter Singer, Princeton's rock star philosopher, famous for sort of saying it's okay to kill babies. Very good argument. I totally defend his, like, you better not tell me that's a bad professor. He's a good professor. Peter Singer, he's Australian. So the Australian guy asks some question, and he's like, all right, Slavoj, so what do you think about this and that? I'm a utilitarian. Sounds a little bit like you don't like happiness and all that. And Slavoj is like, oh, Peter Singer, when the communist revolution takes over, we will make sure all intellectuals like you, degenerates, go straight to Gulag. But listen, Peter, listen very carefully. On Sunday, you get a soup with the one matzo ball. Okay? But you, you're a good guy. You get two matzo ball. So, so part of me feels like, you know, maybe she's kind of, it's, maybe there's a tongue-in-cheek sense to her saying it shouldn't be allowed. Or, you know, yeah, like a snarky, like, also something that I'm not laughing at, but that I could right, imagine it, someone it, doing in a fun kind way. Of like
stupid Twitter drama, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I think the things that make it slightly different, though, in this case is firstly, initially, that they're both colleagues who work at the same institution. And Felicia Somnes would later go on to say that she considers David a friend. She didn't say that initially, but she did say that later. Anyway, a whole bunch of Twitter drama breaks out. Yep. And as Twitter dramas want to do, there's a horde of people all jumping on David saying, you are a sexist monster. He very quickly apologizes. He says, oh, actually, this is probably not very tasteful of me. I should have done this. And he deletes the tweet.
I mean,
wait, he deletes the retweet because it wasn't actually his joke.
So their issue is that he was sexist. I thought the issue with that joke is that you're denying that bisexuals could ever be crazy.
I think they were, I think there were as
that,
many.
Isn't that offensive? What about the what about people who are bisexual and bipolar?
I think there were as many criticisms as people.
Okay, well, I just want to, flag that one because it's logical.
Right. Anyway, so he said, yeah, no, guys, I think this was a bit of a mistake. I shouldn't have done this. I messed up. And so it wasn't even his joke, right? It was a retweet, which is just, you know, you post something again that someone else says. So he didn't delete the tweet. He unretweeted it. but this did not appear to be enough. Felicia kind of kept pushing on it on Twitter, all very publicly saying, you know, this is about, and of course people then began attacking her, calling her a hubris harpy and a stupid woman and things like that. Like a mixture of, what I would say is sort of deserved criticism and also just sort of sexist bile. And, you know, this is what happens.
Some really nasty stuff.
Yeah. There's just always what happens. And she starts posting screenshots of all the nasty tweets being sent to her and said, this is what I'm dealing with. I'm being harassed. People are whipping up mobs against me. The whole thing continues to build to a crescendo with people at the Washington Post taking sides, some of them siding with Felicia Somnes and some of them siding with David. One senior journalist, I can't remember his name, he tweets about how Felicia is attacking her colleagues and is creating a uninclusive workplace and is being toxic. They then start sending internal emails to each other complaining about sexism being allowed and the toxic work environment. And because everyone is fighting with each other on Twitter, they're all posting screenshots of the emails that the other side is sending onto Twitter. So basically the internal squabble in this senior newspaper, like one of the most famous newspapers in the world, is being splashed all over Twitter. Anyway, so you'd kind of expect the story to end there because that's often where these stories sort of end in the public eye. But the Washington Post decides that it's going to act. And it acts by suspending David for a month without pay during primary season when he's like doing some of his most important reporting. to punish him for his sexist tweet.
Mm-hmm.
And if the story ended there, if we could have told a story about how, you know, sort of institutions are being held captive by sort of what have been called cry bullies, people who are, you know, using social media as a tool to sort of enact their will upon opponents. I mentioned in the beginning that Felicia Somnes has had battles with the Washington Post, her employer, a few times. I think she tried to sue them in court, like I said. So there's clearly like another whole layer to this, which has got nothing to do with the tweet and the sexism. It's also to do with, you know, workplace drama and grudges. But today she got, or yesterday rather, it came out that the Washington Post is also firing her. And I'll read the email she got that fired her. This is to inform you that the Post is terminating your employment effective immediately for misconduct that includes insubordination, maligning your co-workers online, violating the Post standards and workplace collegiality and inclusivity. As Sally's Tuesday message reminded everyone, the Post expects all employees to adhere to its standards, requiring employees to treat each other respectfully, inclusively, and professionally. Your continued conduct in disparaging your colleagues online disregarded the direction of the newsroom leadership and violated the Post standards. Your public attempts to question the motives of your co-journalists based on their expressions of views different from yours also undermines the Post's reputation for journalistic integrity and fairness. The same is true of your baseless derision directed at our policies and practices and of our commitment to a safe and supportive work environment. We cannot allow you to continue to work as a journalist representing the Washington Post. You will receive a separate letter from the benefits department concerning your eligibility for any other Post benefits upon termination. That's a pretty brutal letter. But
I mean, it does seem to identify what struck me as the salient
point
with her approach, yeah.
Which is that if you have a problem with something your colleague has said publicly, you should presumably at first attempt to, you know, either talk to their boss or talk to them directly and say, this is not okay, and here's why I think it's not okay. Now, she was attacked by this online, and she said, no, I'm doing this because I needed to show the world that journalists at the Washington Post aren't willing to stand for sexism and that he doesn't represent our institutional values.
So I think that, firstly, let's split things into buckets. I think that it's totally fair game to publicly go after a colleague intellectually if your business is intellectualism, right? So and the Washington Post has this, the New York Times has this, all really good. Even within a think tank like the Hoover Institute, which I think covers a pretty narrow spectrum in a way of the ideological, a narrow part of the ideological spectrum, you'll have colleagues who disagree with each other, and they'll disagree with each other publicly. You know, one guy will say to another guy, you think this policy is going to work. I think that's bananas. And here's why I think you're wrong and you're crazy. And people can be quite tough with each other, and they can embarrass each other, because if your whole job is to analyze policy or some particular section of it, whether it's, you know, economic stuff or whatever it is, that's just how it works. You attach a lot of meaning and status and stakes to it. And so if someone else disagrees with you, even if it's about a technicality, that can feel very wounding, but you deal with it. I mean, that's the job. And that's part of what makes academia both exciting and difficult and sometimes terribly boring. If you read academic journals, you know, I think most people don't, but if you read them, and you get through the jargon, and this is actually true of science, sometimes, although often not enough. It's certainly true in the humanities. There's a lot of unoriginal, just nitpicking, just sort of a hint.
Yes.
And some of the best scientific articles are like, we need to do more of that. You need to do the same experiment twice and just show that the other person like didn't put the vial in the right corner of the table. Yeah.
Some stories I've read from people in academia say that there were certain professors, particularly those kind of older ones who were very secure in their career, absolutely loved going to new sort of academics presentations, so their PhD thesis being presented, something like that, and just doing their absolute best to tear it apart and humiliate the person in a very vindictive and unpleasant way. Which is not great, but at least, you know,
so important. Dude, I was listening this week, for example, I gave myself an hour and a bit to listen to this thing. The Hoover Institute does these things where they'll have PhD students and recent PhDs present papers to a working group of like a couple of professors and a couple of other PhD students. And so these guys are presenting a paper on these like young professors are presenting to two old professors in a group of PhDs, a paper about quite an interesting idea, which is trying to measure how quickly something like inflation propagates through a supply chain, or supply chain disruption propagates increased costs through a supply chain. So, you know, here in China, you have the factory shutdown that's shipping off this kind of thing, which is a component for a cell phone. How long does it take to get to the point where the cell phone's price actually increases, because there's like seven different buy, sell, add value, or move around, whatever, logistics as add value, or actually manufacturing add value units in between. and you try and do these statistical analyses in order to figure out, as it were, like you drop the pebble in the pond, how quickly do the ripples spread across it? Okay? They didn't put it quite as nicely as that, but this is the thing that they're trying to do, and they're much better at the numbers. By halfway through, they've given up on the presentation because the two old professors have just undercut in quite serious and technical ways every assumption that they've made. And the two presenters have gotten to the point where they're each asking the other one, and like after the fourth one in a row, where they're like, you know, we don't actually know how to account for that. And you get the sense, okay, what we're dealing with is a model detached from reality with assumptions that haven't really been well established. So they've just been devastated. And I don't know how genuinely devastating they are. Yeah. And so maybe they deserve it. And maybe it's just tough. But then the two old professors start going at each other. They're like, let's leave these guys to the side for a minute. Dude, and these two wonderful colleagues. Yes, they just say the most devastating. They lay down, like one guy says, you've been making the same mistake since 1973. I remember your paper that you wrote. And I love it. And the things all, and it's like, it's so really, it really is about the ideas. And it's, and there's passion and stuff there, and they're invested in it, but it's about the ideas. Okay, so there's like one bucket, which is fighting with your colleagues about ideas in public. I think that's often great, right? There are ways that you can get it wrong, but that's often great. Then there's this other thing of it's not about the work. It's about your own personal conduct. And that is clearly an HR issue, right? So I had a colleague who I was walking around without shoes in the office, and he didn't like that. When we used to have an office. And so he came to me and he said, dude, please don't do that. He didn't put it as politely as that, but he got the message across. And I made sure that I was always at least wearing socks. If he had put that on Twitter. And that I had a first day. If he had put that on Twitter, that would have been wrong. And, which is the point I'm trying to make. I'm just trying to refine your idea that you should go to the person or to the manager. That is totally true for their.
And I think it's kind of a little bit. Part of what's being lost, I think, and I can't, unless you go and read through all of the tweets, it's kind of difficult to get a sense of how nasty and personal a lot of this was. You know, you had colleagues basically calling each other sexists and racists and psychopaths, and that it was very, it was cloaked in a sort of, it was at least, I think, making a pretense at being about some sort of principle. But in reality, it was so clear that there were just some people in this organization who absolutely despised each other, and were making it very well known publicly. And of course, because they cloaked it in the language and sort of, makeup of a sort of intellectual principle point, that's what made it even more toxic than
otherwise. But hold on. So I could say freedom of expression entitles me to walk around without shoes if I like it. And if you've got an issue with someone not wearing their shoes in the office, that's because you've got a Western colonial cultural imprint about what acceptable business attire is. And you need to broaden your horizons and get down with Africa. In Africa, we have chiefs, we have kings, we have mighty men with no shoes who conduct business meetings in the heartland. And I'm just bringing that to the office. And, you know, how can we hold ourselves to a higher standard than the king? I could make that argument, right? You can always defend your behavior by saying, here's a principle according to which my behavior is acceptable. My point is, yeah, it's personal conduct. If your issue is with what someone thinks, with some clearly abstract, some policy issue, some empirical issue, some outside of the self issue, then it's open game. But if it's about what they have done, then maybe you need to get to the point where you blow the whistle in public. But surely the right thing to do is just to start in person.
Well,
say, Gabriel, you're being an idiot.
I think there is a time to to blow the whistle in public. And that's if you raise an issue that you think is very genuinely an issue with your colleagues or with their management or whatever, and they stonewall you, they blow you off, they don't take you seriously, they just tell you to go away and you're an idiot. Yeah,
exactly.
Then it's like, okay, you know, I'm being ignored now. Maybe it's time to take this public. That was very clearly not what happened here.
Yeah, I mean, she clearly doesn't believe in the Washington Post. And I've got to say, the Washington Post, a friend of mine, where I first saw the story of Princeton Buddy, who writes books and stuff, I saw him on Facebook a few days ago post a piece saying, oh, the Washington Post, this old rag, seems to finally have gotten something right. And he posted an op-ed about the firing of Joshua Katz, which we, Professor Katz at Princeton, which we covered a couple of episodes ago, where he was.
You recommended some of his articles about him.
Mm. He was really unjustly fired. He'd already gone through a disciplinary process. He'd already been punished. And then the matter was resurrected. It was not a good case. And this Washington Post article was very gentle and slightly milquetoast. But it said firing this guy was wrong. And I thought, sure, it's a little bit unfair to call the Washington Post a rag. I mean, it is the greatest newspaper in American history. I really do. I love the Post. Anyway, so I thought it was interesting that sort of followed this. Reasons to be excited about going in the right direction there. Okay, so maybe on the other side of the political spectrum, shall we say, David Perdue was basically fired by the people.
Yes. So he runs in the Senate campaign in 2020, at the same time that Trump and Biden are going up against each other. Man, it's already 2022. Anyway, time flies. He got defeated in that Senate election. There does seem to be at least some evidence from polling and stuff they've done that the reason he was defeated was because, so there was two stages to that Georgia election for the Senate. There was the first round where if you don't get 50% of the vote, then the two top candidates go up against each other. And he, I think, won his race in that case. But then there was a second round. And in that second round, between the election and that second round, Trump was going very hard on the election has been stolen stuff, which we've talked about on the show has not really been
the big steal.
Yes, the big steal, but it's not true.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, we talked about that before, but let's not get lost in the weeds too much there. So anyway, he runs for Senate there, and partly because Trump is saying, you know, you need to back me on this steal thing or else you're a traitor to the Republican Party. He also just kind of generally demotivates a whole bunch of people who then don't go out and vote. I think polls found something that like 10%, 20% of the Republicans who voted for Perdue in the national election then didn't vote for him in they stayed in at home runoff. Rather than vote in the runoff, and so he lost. And that's, you know, the Democrats
managed to get the. The point is that the Republican Party would have won Georgia in the Senate, and then kept the Senate.
Right.
But they lose the Senate directly because of Trump's mad, they stole the whole election thing. Okay.
So,
fast forward 2 years and there's a race
There's one more thing here, which is that George Kemp, who's the governor of Georgia, comes under a lot of pressure from Trump and also from Trump's sort of, supporters
He's a traitor.
They say democracy. He's collaborating with the Democrats to steal the election. He shouldn't certify the results of the election as governor. He should basically tell the Georgia electors to vote in favor of Donald Trump.
It's never happened before, but that's because every other election was great. This election was not great. So this time you just need to ignore the votes. Tell them the result is that I won. It's going to be great. Right. That'll make it great.
So he comes to blows with the Republican governor, George Kemp. George Kemp and also his Secretary of State, who is called George Stephanopoulos, I think. I don't know if George is his first name, but I think Stephanopoulos might be his
name. There's anyway. A Stephanopoulos, there's a Gabriel Steele, there's
Steele. Steele's not a great name for cases involving.
Or was it Gabriel Silva? Anyway, there's a Gabriel in there who I quite liked, who was like an election official who, anyway, there were a lot of good Georgians who were like, you know, maybe we wish you won, but you didn't win, and just grow up. Okay. Sometimes you lose.
Right. So Trump is very annoyed with George Kemp, and he runs very aggressively against him. He encourages Republicans to go out to, because they have, of course, primaries in the U.S. where each party chooses their candidates. He encourages Republicans extremely strongly to go against George Kemp, and he decides to back David Perdue, who was destined for the Senate, but is now caught without a job, and suddenly is like, well, if I can't be senator, maybe I should try my hand at being governor.
I like the name Governor.
So David Perdue goes from having his campaign sort of, you know, undercut by Trump to being Trump's foremost champion in Georgia. And this is
Dude, amazing. Just pause there. Okay. I didn't want to go through the whole thing, but I'm glad you have, because just take a breath. This guy would have won. Trump's madness freaked voters out enough that he didn't win. And then he's like, I know how I'm going to win. I'm just going to ride the wave of Trump's madness.
Have you ever seen, there's a meme online which shows some event in history like Italy in World War II. Mm. And then they open up the menu in a video game and they click the change team button. <Pretty much.
laughs> But it's like it's so imprudent. Like,
sorry, you're joining.
Yeah,
the guy was trying to talk about the Georgia Secretary of State. I confused him completely with someone else. His name is Brad Raffensperger.
Raffensperger. Yes, that's the right. Yeah. It was Raffensperger, and the other one was called Gabriel something. Anyway.
Yeah. So anyway, and this right. This is talked about in the primary, in the run up to the primary. They have debates and things. Because, of course, America has political debates, which isn't that nice. Wouldn't it be great if we had those?
Anyway, I imagine the debates go something like this. Perdue, you would have won, but then you said the whole election was stolen. And then people were like, it's not stolen. That's dumb. You're dumb. And now the whole that Dorito, the triangular orange Dorito who said the dumb thing, now he's your best friend. So is this a case of dumb and then dumber? Are you dumb and dumber, Perdue? Are you both dumb and dumber?
It really didn't go like that, though, because George Kemp really did not want to isolate Kemp really did not want to isolate the Trump voters. So he basically just took the line of, look, this is 2020's issue. Let's not talk about it. This is silly. I did exactly what I needed to do as governor.
I would do it again. I want to tell you about what we're going to do going forward. Yeah.
Right.
That's
right,
probably
right.
The smart
anyway. Primary comes and David Perdue gets absolutely crunched in the primary.
It really is an amazing. And let's just, I think what really matters about this result. Okay, so it's 50%. Kemp beats Perdue by 50%. The anti-Trump guy, or the post-Trump guy, the guy who really pushed back against Trump at the time and now is trying to push past him, beats the pro-Trump guy and Trump's endorsee by 50 basis points. And I think what matters about that is it's not just 50 basis points. It's 50 basis points in a primary. And the whole pro-Trump idea is that when you've got primaries and you've got a smaller number of voters – then you get the full-blown red meat domineering effect, orange meat.
You tend to have the most, hardcore members of every party. That's why, you know, people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez can basically win, you know, primaries in her area sort of in almost unopposed. Safe seat because, you know, she's so far to the left, you can't get further to the left unless you're literally a Soviet communist.
climb out of the grave.
Sorry, it's Brian Kemp. I don't know why I've been calling him George Kemp. Sorry, it's Brian Kemp. I'm really bad with names.
I just know he's Kemp. Yes. I know David Perdue because he's been a thing. Kemp was just Kemp. Yeah, a great thing. So Perdue got fired. And this has been a build-up. It's not the first time. We saw the same thing in Virginia last year. the candidates that Trump is not the deciding factor.
Well, it does seem to depend on the state.
Yeah.
So
okay, spoil my states, party, Nick. Jesus,
yeah. So Pennsylvania, it was quite close, but Trump's candidate there, who is Dr. Oz, who came to fame on the Oprah Winfrey Show.
Yeah, dude. The whole reason Dr. Oz won was not Trump. It was the same formula. It is the Trumpian formula of like be a famous TV celebrity. Be really good at like everyone seeing you tell someone what to do and made them heal, and you're like quite a tough guy, and like you know.
He only won by 100 votes, though. It was very, very close. So that's debatable. I think the Pennsylvania governor candidate for the Republicans is very, shall we say, hardcore Trumpy. I think he may even have been at the January 6th protest, right? So he won his primary. Ohio. Trump's backed candidates did very well. So J.D. Vance, who's
the writer, Bill Billy Elegy, we talked about him.
He managed to win his primary. He was actually in sort of third or fourth place in the primary. It was very contested. It was like eight people, three of them had 20% of the vote, kind of thing, according to the polling. And Trump endorsed him, and he managed to win by I think it was about 10 points. So sort of fairly decisive victory. I think he got like 34% of the vote, something like that. So, you know, Trump is not—he's not like basically God in the Republican Party, but he still maintains he's probably more influential than any other single Republican politician.
Okay, fair to say, but the first thing is if you have two candidates that are more or less the same, and then Trump picks one over the other, is that one going to win? That's the big scary thing, because if you've got a situation where like you could be 60-40 ahead of the other candidate, and then just because Trump likes you, sorry, you could be 40-60 behind, and then just because Trump likes you, you end up 60-40 ahead. He has such power that even if you really disagree with him, a lot of people are going to end up agreeing with him just to keep the jobs or keep the chances of keeping their jobs. And that's a nightmare scenario. And this kind of thing,
what you've also seen is
J.D. Vance, like I think the examples you've given are examples where you might say those candidates themselves have something to offer that's attractive, that's appealing, and they happen to continue to be Trump supporters. And I'm not saying that's irrelevant or negligible. That's very, very important for the broader sense of calculation. But it is a separate calculation, what proportion of the party likes him, to the calculation, well, does he have this vote status where he can...
One of the things that has happened is that you've got candidates who normally probably wouldn't do very well, who then try to pip themselves into prominence by getting a Trump endorsement. And as a result, I think Arizona, it was one of the Western states. I can't remember which one, but there was a primary just in that state, right? But one of the Republican candidates paid for advertising in Florida in the area where Trump's house is to boost herself in the hope that he would see it on TV and then endorse her.
I mean, I like the chutzpah, but I mean, J.D. Vance, dude, that guy was like the most famous, he was the most famous, I think he wrote the most famous Trump apology of 2016-2017.
Well, sort of, but he does also, nationwide. The thesis of the book does basically end up saying, yeah, you know, these places that are kind of back Trump, where everyone feels hard done by, at the end of the day, it's their poor life choices that have led a lot of people into trouble. Like,
well, he includes that. Yeah.
He wasn't like a sort of,
he's like
Grimmon Chimer.
I know, this Friday afternoon thing. Dude, no, he was
not going well for us.
He was Grin on Chimer. No, he was anyway, he at the very least you could say like Dr. Oz. He had
he explained the
massive
the
name brand recognition.
The political
and David
shift.
Perdue is a big politician with a national imprint and massive in Georgia. he's not a fly-by-nighter who's like getting the Trump ticket in the hopes that he's going to like have a waterboy moment.
No,
he comes off the sideline and becomes a hero. He was like a pretty obvious hero who got thumped in a state that seems to have learned the lesson. That it's like, it is dumb and dumber to try and double down on the big steel narrative, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what excites me about it. Okay, what's the next big fire? The next big firing is my favorite firing.
But we're going to do Chesapeake Dean.
Yes. Oh, my word. Say that name slowly.
Chesapeake
Dean.
So this
I think that's why we've been getting our consonants and vowels swapped around in fabulous spoonerisms all day. It's because Chesapeake Dean, C-E-S-A, and then his surname, it just combines like B-O-U-D-I-N or something. Something about his name feels very 21st century. You've got the French flavor, Caesar, sounds like Caesar. There's like a little bit of a hearkening back to the sort of fascist dictator of old. And at the same time, you can't place it culturally or linguistically very easily. And so it's got this nice 21st century postmodern eclectic vibe. Chesapeake Dean. Right.
What an
amuse-bouche as a name.
He is sort of what you might call, I guess, kind of the aristocracy of wokeness in America in some ways, right? So his parents belong to a group called the Weather Underground. I don't know if you've some people know these guys quite well. Some of them, some people outside of the States, not very familiar.
Refresh
so the Weather Underground, very radical left-wing militant organization. One of the reasons why the right was so freaked out by Obama, by the way, is because I think he either hung out with or was related to someone in the Weather Underground. Anyway. These guys were a legitimate terrorist organization in the 60s. They were part of that sort of 60s terrorist, far left, we're going to rebuild society.
Black Panther, didn't they think that Black Panther was a bit soft?
Kind of, yeah. So according to their Wikipedia page, their official ideologies were communism, black power, black nationalism, anti-imperialism, and the new left. They were also allied to the Black Panthers and the Black Liberation Army. Anyway, these guys, they built bombs all over the place.
The Black Panthers were like only black and the Weather Underground was a bit more like you could, you could be any race, but we're after the same.
Right. They took their name from a Bob Dylan lyric, which was, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. So radical 60s hippie terrorists, hippie commie terrorists, basically.
I do quite like... I would say that's the best thing about them.
So anyway,
the name, they really started at the peak of everything they were going to do when they named themselves. And then after that, it wasn't ever even almost as good as it was in the beginning.
So his parents, so Jesse Bedeen's parents were David Gilbert and Kathy Bedeen, who were part of the Weather Underground. When he was very young, they went to jail because they were the getaway drivers in a robbery carried out, I think, by the Black Liberation Army, which resulted in the death of two police officers and a security guard. I think one of the police officers may have been the first black police officer in that particular jurisdiction, which is darkly ironic in a very sad way. But anyway, that aside, so they went to jail. He was raised by other people who were sort of, I think, associated with the Weather Underground, but directly implicated. He grew up in the West Coast of America in, I think it was, San Francisco area. And he very much seems to have taken on board a lot of his parents' ideology, in the sense that he believes that America is a fundamentally corrupt and unjust place, particularly with regards to race, that it treats people of different races, well, black people in particular, very badly. He also, I think, probably understandably, has no real love of the American justice system. He mentioned on the campaign trail, when he was campaigning for district attorney in San Francisco, that you know, whenever he saw his parents, he really knew what it was like to have people you love in jail, because he had to go visit them in a maximum security prison. Anyway, on a sort of tangent here, his mom, Kathy Boudin, when she got out of jail, after serving many years, she immediately then, was given a tenured position at Columbia University.
Which is how I got to know about her. Yeah.
Yeah.
hanging out in New York with fancy pants, like campus celebrity professor with this amazing backstory of, I mean, there is something, I will say that there's something about America where you can kind of live anything down.
Right.
You can be an accomplice to killing a black person in the name of black power while stealing money, and you can just live that down. and not like to survive in a community that sees you personally, and it's like, okay, you're kind of low status, but you too know how to enjoy the sunset and feed the ducks and take care of the old people. No, you can swing high. Okay, so that's America for you. So
it's a strange place, yes. So this is his lineage that he comes from, and these guys, you know, they really write. I think they're really involved in the sort of intellectual movement that in the universities produces eventually what we might call modern wokeness. This kind of view that America in particular is a corrupt, racist, evil capitalist society that just oppresses people. So he runs for district attorney. He wins in San Francisco, and he runs quite explicitly on, I don't know how really to describe his
chaos.
His platform.
Chaos. Chaos.
I was going to say in more neutral
Greek
terms.
Chaos.
But basically he thinks that, you know, enforcing the law too much is a sort of discrimination, racism.
You need to get the guttural. You need to get the guttural from the back of your throat. You just chaos.
Right. So he
no
wins.
No police.
On this
everybody,
platform.
Do. You have to explain though. Does he run before or after Black Lives Matter takes over the capital of San Francisco?
I can't actually remember. It was kind of, I think, on part of the same. Yeah, it was 2019, so it was a little bit before.
So a little bit before. So he runs on the platform of chaos, and then he gets what he wants.
Yeah, he's elected.
San Francisco becomes the most sort of
so most controversial,
like
of
Lord of
the
Flies.
All the things he does. One of the most controversial things he does is that he lets a lot of people. Basically, if there's someone on parole and there's an option as to whether to release them or not, he almost always seems to side with the option of releasing them, which has some unfortunate consequences, namely that something like 50% of people released from jail before trial that he decided to release are accused of a new crime while free in San Francisco, according to a study that was done during his tenure. Crime goes up by a large amount, and let's just say that it causes the usually extremely left-wing, extremely sort of woke population of San Francisco to get a little bit freaked out. And so this is a city, mind you, where I think 9% of the population are Republican, something like that. So it is a very, very blue Democratic city. There are no basically Republican political figures. A former Democratic activist decided.
And can I just – I would like to underline this by saying – in my time in America, my favorite city to have visited. I didn't get to live there like I did in New York.
It's a very pretty city.
It's amazing. And hanging out there was amazing. And it has been the center of the third industrial revolution. It really is a very, very, very special place. And not just the nature. It has the largest trees in the world and not just the San Francisco Bridge. Really, the social dynamic is fantastic. So even though there are no Republicans there, Nicholas, I'm sorry to tell you, it's amazing to hang out, but then you do see this sort of strange thing where they elect Boudin, Bedouin, how do you say his name? Chesser
Boudin.
Yes. Okay, so they elect this guy who's like, the thing about his election, I'm interrupting you. I do want you to get back to the important sequence of events here. But the thing about his election is that it is kind of San Francisco's manifestation of the Portlandia idea.
Right. So you hear that this guy's been elected in San Francisco and you're like, well, that makes sense.
That makes sense. So what is Portlandia? Portlandia is like another super liberal part of America, but not nearly as productive. And there you have so much of a maternalistic attitude to how society should work that it ends up going from like the idea is the government should run everything to sometimes it feels a little bit like the government should run nothing. And then you've got the Parks and Recreation sort of TV show, which kind of combines some of the funny Portlandia type characters and some of the sort of mad libertarian type characters who really do want there to be no government. And so you've got local officials being elected on the kind of libertarian ticket of government's the problem, so we're going to vote for this guy to just not do his job. And that's what I was trying to say with Howes. In a way, it feels like his ticket was government is evil. In particular, criminal justice enforcement is evil. So what you need to do is elect me so that I will do less than any other prosecutor would do. And that's going to mean less evil than anyone else would enforce. So the classic libertarian is like, let's vote in someone in the environmental agency who is going to phone it in every day.
You know the character Ron Swanson?
There we go.
From Parks and Rec, right. So he's a guy who's a libertarian. He works in the Parks Department in the show Parks and Rec. And his entire method of dealing with the fact that he works for the government is just to do as little work as possible because he believes that that's the best way to do his job is to do nothing.
He really does believe it. And Eric Boudin, I think he really does kind of believe it.
Like Chesser.
His name is so delicious. I can't every time. I have to mess it up sometimes because the true name is so amazing. Anyway, it's a strange idea. And I think it's an idea that sometimes has its place. That the best thing you can do is nothing at all. Slavoj Žižek says it's the most revolutionary thing you can do. And I think it's great because he's often talking to sort of Marxist teenagers. And that's great. Like, just the most amazing thing you can do is sit down, think about it. It's great. Anyway, it's not the most amazing thing you can do if you're a prosecutor. Crime goes up. Please carry on where you were.
So here's some stats about what happened. Burglaries went up in San Francisco by something like 46%. Compared to the previous year or within a year of him being elected. This is in December of 2020.
Not great.
They sent out a survey to 10,000 crime victims asking them to rank their experience with his office. And they offered raffle prizes for top participation. He kept getting criticized for one of his big platform things was in America, if you commit a very heinous crime and you're pretty close to being 18, they charge you as an adult. So one of the things he did was there was a 17-year-old who I think was in a gang who Deshaun Lumpkin was the guy's name. He was a 17-year-old kid. He shot and killed a 6-year-old, which, as you can imagine, is just against the sort of normal practice of charging him as an adult, he got tried as a minor and only received 7 years in prison. That was the thing that really hurt Chesser Boudin's reputation. There were a whole bunch of cases where people attacked often elderly Asian people. There was a couple ones where I think a black man hit an Asian guy on the head with a pipe. And there was another one where a young Hispanic guy called Ramos Hernandez hit an old Asian guy, beat him up. And Chesser Boudin decided to release him on or at least put him in the mental health division and say that he wasn't going to charge him too strictly and saying that this was in accordance with the victim's wishes. The victim was difficult to interview because he only spoke Cantonese. And apparently the victim's family said, this is rubbish. He didn't want clemency. He wanted, quote, strict punishment. So there were a whole bunch of cases like this where really people got the feeling that he was not on their side, that he was on the side of criminals. And this is a thing that...
So, and there's happened. The combination, right? So you've got the statistics. Yeah. So that means that more people are being directly affected or know somebody in their circle who's being directly affected.
And at the same time, they're seeing these
and then there's
stories.
The celebrity stories.
Yeah.
That,
Anyway, so particularly Asian and Hispanic voters, which always complicates the sort of woke narratives, were particularly
No. Don't jump ahead in the narrative. You are foreshadowing here.
So a former Democratic activist managed to get, because in California you can recall politicians if you get enough people to sign a petition. So there was one against Gavin Newsom, the governor, what was it, last year already? Where he was faced
and Gavin Newsom was really unpopular because he'd been caught breaking COVID protocols. You know, this whole thing with Boris Johnson having one drink in the balcony. Gavin Newsom was having parties.
Dinner. He was having a dinner with the state's health officials.
It's amazing. It's by far the most stunning. We set the rules, but we don't live by them scandal. It's that happened in the middle of where, like, 90% of all the TV and movies you ever see are made. I am yet to see the mock-you version of that. It's like...
Yeah, that's like whatever. In Veep, that would be too over the top for Veep even.
Yeah, yeah. They, someone would send back a note to the scriptwriters. Guys, tone it down. Just tone it down a little bit. Anyway.
But he survived his recall.
He survived, so yeah.
There's a lot of reason really to think tough. That... You know, a sort of lefty Democratic politician in California has nothing to fear. Well, this recall election against Jesse Boudin built up a lot of steam, like I said, particularly amongst Asian and Hispanic voters. His approval rating was 58% strongly disapprove, 18% somewhat disapprove, and 22% somewhat approve, with 8% strongly approving. This was in May of 2022, so he was really unpopular. And 60% of voters who turned up to the recall election voted for him to be thrown out. Now, this is rare for a number of reasons. One, recall elections often don't work. And two, incumbents, and this is one of the reasons why recall elections often don't work, is that incumbents... It's difficult for them to lose, just generally speaking, all things being equal. So then you also consider the fact that this is an extremely left-wing city, which a lot of people, and there were people who publicly said, look, we thought that his policies would work, because a lot of the arguments he made for why you should be super lenient on criminals is that you're not really addressing the real causes of crime. You're punishing just poor people who are victims of circumstance, and that if we tackle the social problems and have a little bit of compassion, we can make our criminal justice system more humane. Well, it turns out that whatever truth there might be to some of that, what he did didn't work.
Yeah. And it irritates people. Yeah.
Yeah. And if there's one lesson to be taken away from this, it's that law and order issues will kill you if you are a politician. The one thing that people do expect from their government, across the political divides, across every sort of almost every ideological bent, except for those two extremes of right and left that you talked about.
Chaos. Excepting the chaos people. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, except for the chaos
people. Who are on both right and left. Yeah.
Right. Does not like disorder. They do not like crime. And if you give the perception that you're soft on criminals, you're going to get toasted, even in such a left-wing city. And so Jesse Boudin was, I think, one of the foremost members of a thing called the Progressive Prosecutor Project, where basically it was an attempt by sort of quite far-left groups, sort of BLM-ish aligned groups, to get people who shared their view of the criminal justice system elected as prosecutors and then effectively not enforce the law as much as possible.
Slow walk, pull a little libertarian game. Like, right. Hey guys, do we need to govern all that much? Let's govern a little bit less. That'll be much better. Right. Yeah, dude, I think it's a fascinating case. I mean, partly because, Robert Braithwaite, Crime, Shame, and Reintegration, amazing book, which I've talked about a whole bunch of times. It's really useful to see that criminal justice involves multiple axes. One of them is the hard law and order side. One of them is the material circumstance side. One of them is the ability of social workers to address issues of antisocial behavior before they become crimes. In other words, if you've got good schools, that really is helpful. That whole thing of like, I'm going to start a boxing gym to keep the kids off the streets, or a karate dojo like the one I went to in Yeovil as a kid. That's real. That is real. It's one of the components. It's not a replacement for police that can apply force, nor is it a replacement for the need for a growing economy, which requires certain right. policies that allow businesses to actually flourish. And the fourth factor, which is why Braithwaite is so important to my life, because he was the first guy to say, look, criminology in America and in the English-speaking world, and in fact, in much of the world, sort of post, unfortunately, Foucault in a way, has completely overlooked the role of esteem. It needs to be shameful in a society to do crime in order for the rest of the factors to work together in a way that really effectively disincentivizes crime. And if you've got large subcultures that promote criminal activity that have gained a kind of tolerance or acceptance in broader society, then you bit buggered. And it was out of that insight that the whole idea of the economy of esteem was born. So they are onto something that you don't want to be in a world where you are shaming criminals such that they can never reintegrate. You need a three-step process. And you definitely don't want to be shaming people as criminals based on features that are not in their control and have nothing to do with what they've done. But the idea of not shaming criminality or of not having armed police and just leaving it all up to the unarmed side of government, the social care workers and the teachers, and to the hopes that enough economic growth together with soft touch psychotherapy is going to get you there. It's just looking at it's just really trying to fight crime with one arm tied behind your back. Anyway, so I think you're totally right. I think that that criminal justice is an issue that cuts across standard political divides. That the lessons being taught here, has it though?
For example,
because the comeback from the Democrat side, from various publications, has been, well, this guy's been recalled. It just proves that San Francisco is way too conservative for true social justice.
Yeah.
And it there reminds me, it's such an amazing response. It's so...
Yeah, there was a great article...
Of the fact that there are some people who literally are beyond learning anything from experience. Their ideology is so self-contained and complete, there ain't no experience that's ever going to surprise them.
No, exactly. You're referring specifically, I think, to an article from New York Magazine, which said, you know, if you really think about it, there isn't the black and working class population, historical population, and New Deal structuring of the city that means that a true progressive candidate can win in San Francisco. Because, until 1963, it was governed by Republicans. That's like half of its history. So the argument was basically that...
before anyone was born that can actually remember voting in this recall election, there were Republicans there. And there's more white people than non-white people in the city. Therefore, it's racist and conservative and... Dude, it reminds me, I told this to my fiance, and she was like, we had a reminder about the sort of New York Times op-ed, three op-eds I've come across now, response to Amber Heard trial, the finding against Heard, where they're like, well, that proves that she's right, eh?
Yeah.
Said the whole society was racist against women or whatever you call it. And then there was a jury, and it found against her. So that just proves they're racist against women. It's like you can't be someone who's that deep in. And then I was like, but hold on, but maybe it is true. Like I can imagine in the Soviet Union or fascist Germany or like apartheid, it's not that hard to imagine a society in which the very fact that the criminal justice system works a certain way is going to prove injustice. And then she was like, but hold on, dude, look at those articles. No mention about the facts of the case. And I,
yes.
Right? So if you want to say, like, the fact that Steve Biko died in police custody and then his death was first declared to be the result of a hunger strike, this proves that apartheid's evil. How does it prove it's apartheid evil? Because there's a material fact.
Right.
Provided to us, by the way,
they
by
lied. God.
There was food in his belly identified by the chief pathologist, Oxford trained, fought the Nazis in the war, on the scene, leaked the information to, by the way, Helen Ziller, published, by the way, in the Rand Daily Mail. By the way, they nearly got cancelled for that, but they fought on. What was the key material fact? That the government had claimed that he died from hunger strike, and the chief forensic pathologist found a very heavy lunch in his belly from like 3 hours before he died. There's a material fact to hang the whole thing on, right? That's what's absent from this. Like, in 63, there was a Republican government in San Francisco. Something about racial demographics proves what they think. That is not a material fact that proves that your outrageous self-fulfilling, logical thing works.
Right. One of the completely insane assumptions baked into that is that sort of this kind of approach to wokeness and soft on crime is very popular with minorities, particularly Black Americans, because the argument is always made.
Wow.
You know, Black Americans are bullied by the justice system. And a lot of Black Americans don't really like the police, but you know what they hate more than the police?
By a lot.
Crime.
According to lots and lots of surveys.
Yes.
Dude, my favorite. The surveys on, do you think your town or your area is under-policed, policed enough, or needs more police? Jesus.
Yes.
It's in my BLM report. It's almost like looking at a race map. Like, not quite, but it's almost like the more Black the area, the more people are saying, please, could you police us more?
Precisely. And it's similar for a lot of other sort of particularly lower income people, regardless of race, but also.
Exactly. You know, so that's why it's not like a race map. It really is like an income and crime map.
Yes. Unsurprisingly, people who get robbed a lot are the most concerned about crime. Who would have thought?
Really?
But yeah, so this
and
is
not and not by the way concerned about crime in the sense that they're concerned the criminals aren't getting enough therapy, enough like foot massages and like hand holding through the process. And that's really not to say that stuff doesn't matter. It's just that it really works much much better if it comes after arrest, conviction, and incarceration. Then it becomes extremely important to, in my opinion, do a little bit of.
Look, some of the sort of the criticisms, particularly the libertarian criticisms of police, particularly in the US, but kind of generally, I think there's definitely some merit in there. The problem is that you need a balance. You need a strong but fair system. You can't have sort of just anyone can do what they like and then we'll all sort it out in a group session afterwards, which is unfortunately, that sounds like a caricature, but you know, the defund the police movement, which this guy kind of came just before, they kind of believe that. And what's interesting is that the mayor of San Francisco, who's also quite sort of far left, and although she's described as to the right of Bill de Blasio.
Of Vladimir Lenin himself.
Yeah. It's like, oh, okay, I mean, this says a whole lot. Who I think originally endorsed defund the police, did not back Chesapeake in his bid to avoid the recall, which suggests
no
that
one...
he looked at the polls and said, nah.
No one who is like just a brazen hypocrite to start with is ever going to publicly change their mind unless the polling says that that's a fashionable thing to do. Maybe there will one day be a craze of falling on one's knees, not in front of another race, but in front of the mirror to say, or a photograph of oneself yesterday to say, I bow down before you, for you were wrong and wicked, and I am innocent and correct because I have changed my mind. I advocate changing one's mind.
I did see a journalist on Twitter, I can't remember their name, you know, par for the course today apparently, but who
if
said...
If you couldn't remember that name, you'd probably mispronounce it, so maybe it's for
probably,
the
least. Who said... very publicly, look, I backed Chesapeake Dean's election because I thought his policies would work, and they didn't. And I think that we should admit that they didn't work and move on with our lives and not call everyone who didn't vote for him a racist.
Well, dude, that person, you should remember his name, actually, or her name.
Yeah, her name, her name. I remember that she had a black and white photo on Twitter, but apart from that, I can't remember anything about it. Except that she was a senior journalist at a publication. And she had a black and white photo on Twitter.
My recommendation is that Nick finds that person's name and puts it in the
dude,
recommendations.
I seriously think I need some omega-3 oils because my brain is not working today. I haven't drunk anything. I'm not intoxicated.
It's been quite a week. Hey? Oh my word. Yeah. I've had a stunningly tricky week. Anyway. I'm really glad it's Friday. Let's
move on to recommendations.
And move on to recommendations. So, Bundesliga Kobane, fired. Chester Boudin, fired. Whatever, dude, these are awesome. Don't get in the way of my just desserts. I am tasting the saffron vanilla ice cream with little pecan kind of honey crusted croutons in the middle. It's delicious, okay? Chester Boudin, Busisiwe Mkwebane, David Perdue, fired. Who else did we have? Was it just those three?
Felicia Somnes.
Felicia Somnes, fired. I think it's really nice. People who complain about cancel culture have some valid complaints under some disambiguations, but sometimes they really irritate me because in real life, you need to fire people.
This is you being a philosopher and being like, well, you see, it depends how we define cancel culture. If we define it as firing anyone ever, then it's not a good thing to oppose. But you know what they mean when they're whinging about cancel culture.
Oh, no, dude, I don't. I don't think they know what they mean. And as a derivative matter of the fact, I think often when people complain about cancel culture, they're like, you were mean to someone who's my friend or who I like. Sometimes.
Okay, fair enough. There are some people who get it a little bit.
Sometimes. Okay, so yesterday on SABC1, can I say my other favorite thing about this week?
Go ahead.
So there was a professor, so it's like an hour-long session. Dude, they advertised this thing. They were like, hey, do you want to come on the show? And I was very happy that they let me on. And afterwards, by the way, they said, please come back on. We're going to organize this. 1.7 million people watching. That's nice to have like 1.7 million people watch theoretically while some guy says that you're definitely racist. not because of anything you've done or said, but just because you're white. Like I told this anecdote about how, talking about like, you know, tertiary institution racism, and I was saying there's definitely racism in tertiary institutions. It's definitely not the biggest issue that you're going to face at tertiary institutions. When it does happen, deal with it with discipline. You know, what can you do? Like report things, never be quiet, but you know that when you report things, there's going to be an investigation. Maybe it's not going to go your way. Check that it's reason responsive, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, I want to add one of the big issues is that the private school kids are, as far as I can tell, doing really well at university because they're getting a quality education. And I got the statistic that about half of private school kids in the top 30 private schools in the country are not white. So I knew, like, when I visited Hilton, it's the last private school that I really visited, most of their younger grades in, like, grade 8, 9, 10 are not white. And, like, grade 11 and 12, it's, like, 50-50, 55, 45, something like that. That's the most expensive boarding school. But I wasn't sure about the rest. Is that, like, a standout? Anyway, we got this figure from a study from 2019, and presumably the figures keep climbing. Okay, so I wanted to just say, you know, like, really, there is this thing where if you're going to a public school, you know, we've got the worst public school system in the world, and literally in the world on a bang for buck basis. 5% of kids starting in grade 1 are going to finish matric with a pass in maths. 20% in grade 4 can read. 80% in grade 4 cannot read. That figure, as far as I can tell, has actually been getting worse since 2006. So, you know, if you can get into university, that's great. You might need a little extra support. Maybe reach out to a bursary program, not for the money, but for the mentorship, for the tutorship, for getting someone to tell you about that delayed gratification of, like, you know, you might not feel it the first couple of weeks that you study an extra hour every day more than the guy next to you. But after 2 months, you are going to start feeling it, and it's going to be good. And when you're more confident, by the way, if someone accuses you of racism, you're going to be able to resist it. And IRI still has a couple of bursaries. Please reach out. One of the countries was the country's biggest bursary program. You know, if we can't help you, we'll find someone who can. So. And then the host turned back to me and said, "It's a very sad thing to disagree with you."
Oh.
Dude, dude, if you want to know what the rest of what
your
he said,
your frozen heart beat for a moment.
Dude, he totally disagreed with me, but I thought, wow, I've gotten to the stage where it's not like a delight to disagree with me and jump on me. It's like sad to disagree with me. Anyway, so that made me very, very delighted, and I felt like a version of a kind of a barrier that sometimes I feel just it got fired. It's like a little barrier got fired that I thought was really sweet. So there's a I don't know, kind of brag, but anyway, I really enjoyed it, and I had some reason to bring it up that wasn't just about bragging about my nice experience, but I can't remember. I'm not going to pretend that I can. I probably will in a minute, but we're running over time, and I have a very important thing to go to. So let's jump into recommendations.
All right. Do you have a recommendation?
I do, actually. I'll go first this time, if that's okay. So Peter Robinson and Bill Barr, William Barr, have a discussion that was put on YouTube yesterday. Peter Robinson, I don't know. I've had a bit of a kind of an intellectual crush on this guy since 2012. I can remember when
he does all the Hoover Institute interviews, doesn't he? What's his program called? Uncommon Knowledge.
Yeah. So he was one of Ronald Reagan's top speechwriters during Reagan's presidency. And what he helped do as a sort of dude in his 20s or 30s was he was very well trained and very smart, but he kind of helped just give like a natural language translation of the big ideas. And I think that's a beautiful skill. It requires a profound understanding of policy matters as well as a profound understanding of human psychology and a humility, really. Anyway, he didn't tell Reagan's jokes. You know, I think some of the most famous moments in terms of Reagan's rhetoric are his telling of the Soviet jokes. But some of the most famous moments really. Yeah, Peter Robinson does have a hand in, and he's only, I think, in the last few years, actually, he's written about it before, but I think he wrote a memoir, and then he did an interview tour where he sort of talked about these things. Anyway, I knew someone who knew it personally, told me all about this back in the day. And his way of perpetuating this ability to translate from very high intellectual domain of ideas into a sort of street level, we're sitting around the fire, let's talk about what matters in life thing, has been to be at the Hoover Institute and do most of their interviews for a long time, decades. And anyway, this interview is with Bill Barr, who was effectively what we would call the National Prosecuting Authority, the Shamila Batoy of America, for almost 2 years under Donald Trump. For the first 2 years of Trump's presidency, it was Jeff Sessions.
Bashed by many people as being a Trump suck-up.
Yeah. So first it was Jeff Sessions, and Trump gets rid of Sessions because he says, you know, dude, it's just I've been letting it go and letting it go and letting it go, but you're indulging all kinds of Russiagate ridiculousness, and it's getting in the way of me actually doing my job, so I'm going to fire you. And then there was questions about whether this is just like Watergate wasn't the problem with Nixon firing people that are trying to investigate him. Turns out that there are substantial differences. One of them being that Nixon was actually guilty of knowing about the hacking of the Democratic National Convention's sort of HQ planning center, and also guilty of quietly trying to shut it up. Whereas Trump was not guilty of colluding with Russia. So the obstruction of justice thing is very difficult. It's just a whole difficult, different kind of argument. Anyway, because Bill Barr, the biggest thing that he did in a way to irritate the left was when the Robert Mueller report came out against Donald Trump. Well, the Robert Mueller report was the report into collusion. And it said that...
pretty much exonerated.
It said we've got no evidence that there's been any collusion. We've investigated for 2 years. We've had hundreds of millions of dollars, or however much it was, maybe more, and we can't find anything. But we're not exonerating him either. And Bill Barr preceded it before the redacted version went out by saying, look, no evidence of collusion was found against Trump, literally quoting directly from it. And then Robert Mueller was like 2 days later, he was like, this is terrible. Bill Barr is creating a false impression that we exonerated him. We specifically said we didn't exonerate him. And so then for months, the left-wing media was like, the Mueller report does not exonerate Donald Trump. And Bill Barr's argument was like, if you understand anything about how our criminal justice system works, the only place that you can be exonerated is in a court after you've had a trial. Then it finds you guilty or not guilty. But before that court process, you are presumed to be innocent. You can't be exonerated. You are already exonerated until someone finds enough evidence to take you to court. It's literally illegal. Like, this is not a – it's like trying to – it's like if a public official tries to
– Gabriel, I found no evidence that you stole my socks, but I can't exonerate you either.
Dude, you can't knight me. You can't benight me. You can't make me like the ancestor queen. There are just some things legally you can't do. You cannot exonerate me. I'm already exonerated. Anyway, that legal argument fell on deaf ears amongst a bunch of experts. Anyway, so the point is, I mean, the pitch for this episode is the first sentence. This is an interview about Bill Barr's memoir. And by the way, Barr dropped Trump after the election and before the insurrection. He was just like, Trump is going on and on and on about the election was stolen.
Right, because Trump asked him to look into the stolen election, and he did look into it, and he said, I can't find evidence that this thing was stolen.
Yeah, I mean, by the way, he didn't say that there wasn't, like, irritating stuff. He was like, there's a whole bunch of things that I wish it was different. There's a whole bunch of things that, like, next time you'd want to do differently. Rules that were accepted that weren't properly challenged. But once the rules are in place, you've got to stick to the rules. You know, in terms of like vote harvesting, can you have people going around and collecting votes from their homes? How do you deal with the mail-in ballots that aren't dated? Whatever. But in terms of actual fraud, actual faking stuff, he's like, it's just not passing muster. And by the way, the big news of today is footage of Ivanka Trump saying, you know, when Bill Barr said it, I accepted it. There's no fraud. Daddy's being a dummy. Okay. The last bit I've editorialized. But rest,
essentially, yes.
You can see it in her eyeballs. She's like, he's going to be dead soon. I'm still going to be alive. I'm sorry if I'm being rude. I just really, I'm so irritated by that event. Anyway, I think sincerely the point is that he was the kind of guy that carried credibility inside of the Trump administration and said, this is the point where you should stop complaining and just accept a loss. And he was ignored. And so he resigned. And so on the Trump camp, on the David Perdue camp, Bill Barr is just another sellout to the left. And on the left side, he's just another Trumpkin, another guy who tried to help out.
Jumped off the boat too early, earlier than the others.
Yeah, well, later than the others. He was like the last rat to jump off, right?
Well, no, because I think they assume that more will go off the ship in time because the story's not over yet.
Okay, yeah. No, but the first rat, you know, there are lots of guys quitting from the first year in time. Anyway, but the point is that this interview is just a nice summation of what it is like to be inside the room coming from someone who doesn't have ideological beef with Trump. And I think that makes it interesting. So he's got complaints and he's got compliments, but they're sort of framed by someone who thinks that it was great that America got a bipartisan turn against China, that it was great that the Abraham Accords happened, that it was great that unemployment amongst racial minorities in America hit record low levels, that real-term wages for the working class increased for the first time in a couple of decades, et cetera. And I'm not arguing the merits of who, what, when, and why is really responsible for that. But for someone who goes in feeling like that's all okay, and that itself doesn't create a reason to try and be nasty and hateful, it allows a different kind of conversation to one that I've seen in a long time. Maybe it's just that I haven't watched anything to do with American politics in the last couple of months, but I found it extremely calm, cool, collected, insightful, slightly depressing, because of the madness on the right and the left. And just really, really strong recommendation. It's the best thing I've seen on YouTube this year.
Yeah, America is only allowed to have one insane party at a time. It can't have two insane parties at the same time, because then the world is not in a good place. What am I going to recommend? I had something here now. I guess, I don't know if this is a very strong recommendation in the sense that I'm not recommending something specifically, but I was doing a little bit of reading for my research piece, for my weekly This Week in History article, and I was writing very briefly about Indira Gandhi, who was the third Prime Minister of India. She was, shall we say, a controversial figure in Indian politics. She ruled by decree for a bit after declaring a state of emergency, and she ultimately was assassinated by some of her own bodyguards. In retaliation for ordering the Indian army to storm the Sikh holy temple at Amritsar, at the Golden Temple there. She's a really interesting character, because I think a lot of the problems that kind of, at least from my sort of ideological perspective, that bedevil India today, I think do have some roots in her story. I think there are also some lessons for South Africa, because one of the great points of her story is that she tries to rule by decree. She declares a state of emergency after battling with the courts. And that state of emergency is forced to end because of huge public pressure, and the opposition wins the next election. Now, she gets back into power after that, but the point is that India managed to save its democracy in a moment of crisis. And so I think she's sort of a key figure. She was also sort of aligned India with the Soviet bloc and nationalized a whole bunch of industries and stuff. So let's just say I'm not a huge fan, but a fascinating character nonetheless, also because she's sort of in some ways the founder of Bangladesh, because she helped Bangladesh's independence movement break away from Pakistan, which is a very interesting event in world history. Anyway, so I guess my recommendation is just, if you can find anything to read about her on Wikipedia, if you have a book about it, she's a really interesting character, and one who left such a mark on Indian politics that India's big opposition party today, the INC, which was, you know, her party, is still governed by, I think, some of her kids or her grandkids, which is quite the legacy in politics.
And if you're looking for places to read about her, start at the Daily Print with Nicholas Lorimer.
Look, my piece is very much I was learning about this recently too. It's not a period of history that I was super familiar with. The first time I ever read about it was when I was reading about the life of India's current Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, who cut his teeth as a political activist, ferrying banned pamphlets and material between safe houses during the state of emergency that were criticizing it. So, I mean, there's yet another way that this woman was a huge force in the presence of in the history of shaping modern India. And as India is an increasingly important country, I think it's an important person to read about. She also, I think, in a lot of ways, one of the things she really tried to do was continue her father, who was the first Prime Minister of India's goal of secularizing India. moving it away from sort of religious sectarian currents. And the continued dominance of the BJP, India's current ruling party, and the, I think it's called the Hinduvada ideology, which is a sort of Hindu nationalist ideology, suggests, I think, that ultimately, in that respect, she definitely failed. Anyway, a very fascinating historical character. Check her out if you don't know much about her. But I think that that's all that we have for today. I see Gabriel's already preparing to go out and do his many interesting and exciting things. So I think we're going to call it there. I hope that you all have a wonderful time and keep the flag of liberty flying.